The controversy over the payment of protection money to criminals at building sites in Cherry Orchard in Dublin provides the lead story in four of today's papers. The Irish Examiner takes the line that Owen Keegan and senior bosses at Dublin City Council are under increasing pressure to explain if they knew about the payments. The Herald, meanwhile, publishes a front-page story, which the paper ran 3 years ago, revealing that a council probe was underway into claims that a criminal mob was providing security at the West Dublin building sites. This was the first I heard about it. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Daily Mail, which quotes comments made by Housing Minister Owen Murphy during an interview on RTÉ Radio yesterday in relation to that controversy. And in its lead story, the Irish Daily Mirror quotes comments made by Fine Gael councillor Danny Byrne, in which he says, "When I heard about this, I thought I was in Naples. This is like something straight out of the Mafia." The Irish Independent leads today with details of a confidential document which is thought to have come from Taoiseach the Simon Coveney, which warns that a no-deal Brexit could impact on the Irish fishing industry, since the loss of access to UK fishing zones could displace vessels from other EU countries. The document also suggests that undermined public confidence in the security of food and medicine supplies could lead to panic buying amongst consumers. The allocation of €110 million to the agricultural sector in this week's budget in the event of a no-deal Brexit provides the lead story in today's Irish Farmers Journal. And for its lead story, the Belfast Telegraph characterises today's meeting between the Taoiseach and the British Prime Minister as the last hope of a deal being reached. Backstop battle as time runs out is the headline there. Donald Trump's defence of his decision to withdraw American troops as Turkey began its military incursion into northeast Syria yesterday provides the lead story in today's Irish Times. And the Irish News leads today with the tributes paid to double All-Ireland winner and former Down manager Eamon Burns yesterday following the news of his sudden death at the age of 56. For its lead story, the Irish Daily Star reports that Patrick O'Brien, who has served 6 years of a sentence for the rape and sexual abuse of his daughter Fiona Doyle, was rushed to hospital from his cell in Arbour Hill Prison yesterday. The Echo leads today with a report about how Gardaí are patrolling a bus route in Cork City following reports that schoolboys had been robbed on their daily commute. And finally, the Irish Sun leads today with the spat between the wives of two high-profile English soccer players. Lots of today's other papers also give front-page coverage to Wayne Rooney's wife Colleen's post on Instagram yesterday accusing Jamie Vardy's wife Rebecca of leaking personal stories about her to the Sun newspaper after she had conducted an online sting operation in which she posted fake stories on her personal account. Not surprisingly, the headline writers today are having a field day. Wags at War is the headline on the front of the Mail and Star. It's Wagro in the Sun and Roodunnit in the Independent.
My personal favourite this morning, Waggy Leaks. I think the Sun have that one as well. Fiona, thank you very much. The Taoiseach will travel to England this morning for talks with the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Although Mr. Johnson has said he remains cautiously optimistic that they can reach agreement on Brexit, there are few signs of a breakthrough. The disagreement centres on the handling of customs arrangements between North and South and the proposed role of the Stormont Assembly and Executive. Yesterday, the EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, said it was not currently possible to reach agreements with the UK. For more, we can talk to Stephen Erlinger, who's the chief diplomatic correspondent in Europe for the New York Times. Good morning.
Good morning.
Is there any optimism left in Brussels that agreement can be reached?
To be honest, not much, no, because this British government has pulled back from the earlier British government, made things much more complicated. There is this sense that actually Boris Johnson doesn't want a deal. What he wants is an election. He needs an election. So one has the strong feeling both sides are actually treading water to get past October 31st. Lots of mysteries. You know, will Britain crash out on October 31st despite the law? Who knows? But I think the European Union believes that it will not be the one to pull the trigger. That will have to be Britain. And it is, I think, willing to give Britain some more time to figure itself out. If that requires an election, fine. But I don't think anyone really expects a deal. There's just no time to even negotiate an operable, legally operative deal.
And I note quite a bit of speculation in this morning's newspapers here and in the UK and elsewhere, saying that if there isn't significant progress over the next couple of days, that these talks might come to an end.
Well, I think that's really quite possible. I mean, you know, in the end, looking at this neutrally for the last 3 years, there is an unresolved issue, and everyone knows what it is, and it is the border on the island of Ireland. And to be honest, the backstop was a way of pretending that problem never existed, but it was always going to exist. It's very hard to imagine even a free trade agreement that would have resolved this border problem, because from the EU side, the single market is a holy thing, and it has to have checks. So I think we're back still to the same problem we've always had, which is how you preserve the borderless island of Ireland once Britain leaves the EU. And of course, now that this British government says, oh, well, Northern Ireland has to stay in the British customs union, it's almost impossible. You're going to have some kind of checks somewhere, somehow. Otherwise, you know, we're living in fantasy land, I'm afraid.
The suspicion for many, I think, over the past few days in particular, is that a lot of what Boris Johnson is now saying, and certainly pretty much everything his spokesman is saying, is aimed more at the British electorate than at the EU.
Well, I think that's totally true. I mean, that's true of most, you know, government leaders. I imagine that Taoiseach has in mind what his words mean to his electorate, too. But I think that's true. As I say, I don't think, you know, the feeling is that Boris Johnson wants a deal. It'd be nice if he could have one, because it deals an end to Nigel Farage. But I don't think at this point there's a deal that is politically acceptable to Boris Johnson as he prepares for the election that everybody knows that he needs.
So what then? Legally, he is obliged to ask the EU for an extension to the deadline, though I noticed that last night that the business secretary, Andrea Leadsom, was essentially saying that Boris Johnson was gearing up to try and bypass that obstacle as they see it, and that there might be some way of doing this.
Well, I know. I mean, this is really magical thinking. But, I mean, what Andrea Leadsom, as I understood it, was saying is, well, we'll send two letters, because we have to send one letter because Parliament requires us to ask for an extension. But at the same time, we'll send another letter saying, actually, don't bother. We really don't want one. Now, I don't know how Brussels would respond to that, frankly. Maybe it would decide that Parliament is the real ruler in Britain, and it would listen to Parliament's letter and not, I mean, who knows? I mean, right now, there's a lot of magical thinking going on. And as you're saying, quite rightly, it's a lot of it is simply political campaigning to gear up for an election. After all, Boris Johnson has no majority left. Jeremy Corbyn is at a weak moment. The Remain side seems very divided. Britons are sick of the whole thing. I think everyone's sick of the whole thing. But I don't see a resolution, I'm afraid, because as I tried to say from the beginning, you're trying to resolve something that is essentially irresolvable under the current givens.
Stephen Erlinger, thank you very much indeed for taking our call this morning. Stephen Erlinger there, he's the chief diplomatic correspondent in Europe for the New York Times.
Turkish troops are continuing an assault on towns in northern Syria this morning, days after a decision by the US president to take his troops out of the area. People are trying to leave the area, and Reuters are reporting smoke rising from buildings in the town of Ras Al Ain. Turkey says it's protecting its southern border from Kurdish terrorists. Kurdish fighters were key US allies in helping to defeat the Islamic State group in Syria. In a TV interview overnight, the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that the US did not give Turkey a green light for its offensive. Journalist Jasper Mortimer is based in the Turkish capital. We can speak to him now. Jasper, good morning.
Good morning.
What is Turkey doing?
Well, officially, the Turkish government says its reason is, as you said just now, to protect its southern border from a terrorist corridor along the border of northeastern Syria. It also says that once it has secured that area, wiped out the Syrian Kurdish militia, whom it describes as a pack of terrorists, it will then use the the area that it is controlling to resettle up to 2 million Syrian refugees now in Turkey will be resettled in northeastern Syria. Now, the facts are that there hasn't been the level of cross-border violence along that border that would justify such a large operation. That border has been quiet. I think the last time there was any cross-border activity was early last year during Turkey's intervention in the northwestern Syrian province of Afrin, when one day the Kurds in northeastern Syria, in retaliation for what was going on in northwestern Syria, fired rockets into southern Turkey. Nobody was killed. But, you know, that was a one-off thing. The Kurds of northeastern Syria have been running their autonomous zone very well. It has been the one part of Syria where international NGO workers could visit without fear of getting kidnapped. The Kurds have set up their own administration there. They hold elections. And I think this is what actually worries Turkey, the idea that in this Kurdish heartland of Syria, the Kurds are setting up a mini-state and trying to emulate their Iraqi Kurdish cousins who have got almost an independent state in northern Iraq. Turkey doesn't want the Kurds of Syria to become as strong and almost as independent as the Kurds of northern Iraq, because such moves would embolden Turkey's Kurds. The Turkish Kurds would say to the government here in Ankara, why can't we have the autonomy that our cousins in Syria and Iraq have? So I think this operation ultimately is designed to crush the Syrian Kurdish administration and end the Syrian Kurds' dreams of setting up a Kurdish autonomous zone in northern Syria.
If Turkey is successful and takes control of the area, what effect will it have on Syria?
Well, it would certainly reduce Damascus's chances of regaining control over northern Syria, that is for sure. Damascus has come out very strongly against this operation, calling it a violation of its sovereignty. Some people think that privately Damascus will be happy that Turkey is hammering the Kurds, because ultimately Damascus plans to negotiate a settlement across all of Syria, including with its Kurdish citizens, and by Turkey hammering the Kurds and probably wiping out the Kurdish militia, Turkey will be weakening the Kurds' hand at the negotiating table. The Syrian Kurds constitute 10% of Syria's population.
Jasper, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. That's Jasper Mortimer, a journalist based in the Turkish capital, Ankara.
Ireland could see a substantial fall in its take of corporation tax under new proposals from the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development. Under the plan, companies would have to pay more tax in countries where they generate profits. The winners would be large countries like the US, China and Germany, and possibly developing nations. With us is Jim Stewart. He's Associate Professor of Finance at Trinity College. Good morning.
Good morning.
We've spoken about corporation tax many times before.
Right.
In simple terms, what is being proposed by the OECD?
Well, I think the background is very important, because you may recall that some years ago the EU tried to reform international corporation tax because it's widely recognised that it fails in various ways. Some companies pay very little or no tax. Ireland vetoed these proposals, the formula tax and also a digital tax. Now, at the same time, some countries such as the UK and France said they would introduce a digital tax unless the OECD introduce some sort of consensus about a tax. So the OECD then, after some much deliberation, have produced what's called a public consultation document. It's very flimsy, it's only about 17 pages, and this outlines some proposals for a digital type tax. Now, the thing is, there are two components. they proposed that business would be profits would be split into two components: one, normal ordinary profits, and they would be subject to transfer pricing rules, and other aspects of their profits would be subject to a digital type tax. The proposals are complex, and the more complex they are, the greater the scope for tax avoidance type strategies. It also involves consensus, and as you say, there are winners and there are losers. So it's not clear that the OECD proposals will actually be implemented. But whatever's happening, there will be a digital tax introduced, because there isn't an OECD proposal. France and the UK and other countries will introduce a digital tax, as indeed other countries already have one.
Is it fair to say then that the gist of these proposals is that even if a company doesn't have a physical presence in a country, if they do a lot of business there, they should pay some tax there?
That's right, yeah. They're going to change what are called the nexus rules. And because it may be difficult to understand, but it's actually very difficult to work out where a company is located. So these nexus rules will say that if you have sales but you don't have a physical presence, then you're located in that country and you will pay tax in that country.
We've seen a situation develop here where corporation tax has become more and more important to the exchequer. What would the implications be for Ireland if these plans did come to fruition?
Well, it means that our corporate tax take would fall, but it also means that Ireland would become less attractive as a location for foreign direct investment. If they're here because of the tax incentives, and the tax incentives are reduced, well, then that might suggest that they will leave here, or they reduce their operations in Ireland, they become less dependent on Ireland.
What's likely to happen to these proposals? How much weight do they have, do you think?
Well, I think that the document, as I say, is very flimsy. It's only 17 pages. And there's a lot to play for in these proposals, so it depends on the outcome of negotiations amongst the OECD. And there's no doubt that the US objected to the EU proposals because they said they were discriminatory, and because it particularly against US companies. So it's actually quite difficult to see a consensus emerging that would satisfy all members of the OECD. Some members will be satisfied, but others will not be, I think.
And yet you believe some sort of change is coming?
Oh, there definitely will be some change, because France and the UK have said if the OECD do not agree to consensus, they themselves will introduce a digital tax. And other countries, we must remember, already have a digital tax: Australia, India, Indonesia and other countries. And Spain and Italy, I think, have a digital tax as well. So change is definitely coming, but what the nature of that change is uncertain at the moment.
Jim Stewart, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Jim Stewart there, Associate Professor of Finance at TCD.
Good morning, Rachel. Thank you. Apple has removed an app from its online store that was widely used by pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. Apple claims the Map app endangered police. It was removed following a claim from China's state media that it helps rioters. In a statement, Apple said it had verified that the app was being used to target and ambush police. Trade talks between the US and China resume in Washington today. Bloomberg is reporting that the US is considering a currency pact with Beijing as part of a partial deal. The White House has branded China a currency manipulator in the past. It's understood the deal might involve a suspension of next week's threatened tariff hike. UK growth figures for August are due to be published this morning, which would give some indication as to whether the economy is heading for a technical recession. The British economy contracted by 0.2% in the 3 months to the end of June. On the currency markets this morning, the euro is trading at just below 90 pence sterling and $1.10.
Damien O'Mara, good morning.
Gavin, good morning to you. As has been mentioned elsewhere in the programme, for the first time in Rugby World Cup history, tournament organisers have been forced into the cancellation of games. Saturday's meeting of England and France in Pool C, and that between New Zealand and Italy in Pool B, will now be recorded as scoreless draws. That decision has been taken because of the dangers to public safety posed by the super typhoon Hagibis to the Tokyo, Yokohama and Toyota regions. It means England will progress as pool winners ahead of France. New Zealand will top their pool ahead of South Africa. Ireland's game with Samoa on Saturday in Pool A is unaffected so far. A decision will be made on Sunday morning local time about playing the game between Japan and Scotland in the same pool later on that afternoon. Japan topped the pool with 14 points. Ireland have 11. Scotland have 10. It means all three teams could still progress to the knockout stages. A bonus point win for Ireland on Saturday would bring with it a quarterfinal place, irrespective of the Japan-Scotland game going ahead. It also means the winner of Ireland's pool will face South Africa in the quarterfinals. The runners-up will play New Zealand. Joe Schmidt will name his starting lineup at 8 o'clock for the Samoa game. Our rugby commentator Michael Corcoran is with the team.
Yes, good morning, Damien. Obviously, the headlines here overnight have been dominated by match cancellations, but the team expected to be confirmed in the next 25 minutes by the head coach, Joe Schmidt. We were told during the course of the week that Robbie Henshaw is ready and available for our selection, so I'm expecting him to come back into the starting team. During the course of the week, Andy Farrell gave a kind of slight hint that maybe everything wasn't right with Rob Kearney in terms of that maybe a bit of an issue with his groin. I suspect they'd like to have a look at Jordan Larmour at fullback, and he might get the opportunity to play against Samoa. Elsewhere, I think we're going to go pretty full strength. There might be some changes in the back row. Now, Reece Ruddock was excellent when he came on and played last week and has come off the bench on a number of games. He could be involved, although I suspect... I think it's probably going to be someone like Reece Ruddock or maybe Tadhg Byrne in the back row, and Peter O'Mahony perhaps on the bench. Certainly it does appear from conversations I've had with people during the course of the week that Joey Carby will be involved off the bench, I would say. Otherwise it's going to be locked and loaded for Joe Schmidt in Ireland as they try and book a place in the quarterfinal of the competition, but all will be revealed shortly after 8 o'clock your time.
And we'll have reaction from Eddie O'Sullivan at 8:30. In Gaelic Games, the appointment of a new hurling manager in Clare has been delayed following a meeting of their county board last night. Neither the name of Louis Mulqueen or Brian Lohan was put to the clubs for ratification as was expected. Both had been interviewed for the job on Monday evening. That process has now been extended until October 21st. Over the course of the week here on Morning Ireland, we've broadcast the draws for the Provincial Football Championships for next year, and coming up after 8:35 we'll have confirmation of the fixtures for the Hurling Championship for 2020. In soccer, Mick McCarthy's senior Republic of Ireland squad travelled to Tbilisi today ahead of Saturday's Euro 2020 qualifier with Georgia. There was a boost yesterday with Shane Duffy travelling with the squad. He had initially been a doubt with a calf problem. McCarthy is already without the injured Richard Keogh and the suspended Enda Stevens. Glenn Whelan is likely to anchor the Irish midfield on Saturday afternoon. The 88 times captain midfielder has largely opted out of media duties in recent years after, I think unfairly perhaps, being one of the more maligned players in the camp. Glenn has been chatting this week with our correspondent Tony O'Donoghue about his ongoing presence on the international scene and dealing with some of the more personal criticism directed at him.
There were certain things and I stepped away from doing press and doing stuff because there was things said and it got a little bit personal, whereas I think there was where I was from was brought up and certain cars that I was supposed to be driving, which I didn't, and that stuff I was just thinking, do you know what, I don't need it, so I just kept my head down. Listen, like I said to you, there's people out there who will criticise no matter how good I do, but I've got rhino skin, do you know what I mean, I'll take it on the chin, and now I'll just get on with it. I've played 88 times for Ireland now, and nobody can take that away from me.
But it must have been very hurtful on a personal level.
For me, it was fine. As in, it's football. You accept it, you take it. It's part and parcel of playing, being a player. But wife, mum and dad, I've got two kids now who are grown up. And when they start saying it, they didn't particularly like it. And they were very hurtful of it. But like I said, it's... What can you do with... Do you sit back and accept it, or do you just knuckle down and keep at it? So for me, it was a case of, do you know what, I'm not going to listen to anybody. The manager wants me to play. He keeps picking me, so I must be doing something right.
You mentioned the family, of course, and they were all there for what looked like your retirement game. Farewell match, your 85th cap against Northern Ireland. Did you feel that you were being retired?
Well, to be honest with you, I got a phone call from the manager and basically said to me he wanted me to come in against Northern Ireland and captain the side, that he was basically going a different direction, bringing younger lads in and stuff, and I was more than happy with that, to come in, obviously, to get so-called last cap before finishing. And I accepted that. I shook his hands, and obviously the results weren't great at the time, but then the manager left and the new manager's come back in, and I'll say it now, I'll never ever retire. I might not, I'll stop getting picked at some stage, but I won't ever retire. It's my dream. I'm not going to just give it up so easy. So got a phone call from Mick, basically saying, was I retired? And I said the same thing. I said, listen, I know where I stand now. I'm getting on a little bit. Young lads coming through. And he just said to me, but if I need you, would you be available? And I said, of course. So to be still doing it now, and playing a part, hopefully, in achieving something is what we want to do. So now it's been good.
That match kicks off at the unusual time of 2 o'clock on Saturday. It'll be live on RT2 television, also here on RT Radio 1. And finally, two Irish boxers fight for medals at the Women's World Amateur Boxing Championships in Russia today. Lightweight Amy Broadhurst and welterweight Christina Desmond fight in the quarterfinals just after midday. Victory will guarantee them at least a bronze medal.
The Inspector of Mental Health Services, Dr. Susan Finnerty, has said it's astounding that the state has failed to provide adequate rehabilitation services in the sector. Dr. Finnerty blames the long-term neglect of people with severe and enduring mental illness for creating what she called a revolving door admissions practice to the detriment of service users, their families and the public finances. The inspector is appointed by the Mental Health Commission and its chief executive, John Farrelly, is here. John Farrelly, thanks for coming into us this morning. What are mental health rehabilitation services?
So basically, for every 100 people who enter our mental health services, about 14 will develop severe and enduring mental illness where they need very specific support and care in order to recover. So if you think of someone has a stroke, many people that have a stroke, they need rehabilitation, they need care after that in order to enable them to live their lives. The same if you break your leg. If you break your leg, you go to the hospital, they put a plaster on it, they don't tell you just keep the plaster on for 10 years and you'll come back to us. Rehabilitation is about working with people with severe and enduring mental illness so that they can live their life.
And what sort of services are we talking about?
So generally, we have a policy called A Vision for Change, which is now 10 years old, which set out that we would, in closing the big institutions, we as a state, we as a people, would develop community services to support people. And the community services in terms of rehabilitation are specialists led by a trained psychiatrist and a team of nurses, occupational therapists, psychologists. And what they do is they work with the person, and it's meant to be in the community so that they can really look at their illness and recover and really, you know, even if they don't recover, live as well as they can in the community. Yeah.
And where are the gaps?
Well, the gaps are quite astounding, actually. I mean, the more I look at it and the more I look at the inspector's report, I think we have a budding, I know at the moment we look back and we see different things that have happened in our society of neglect and we call them scandals. And you look at this and you'd have to think, you know, this has the capability, unless someone intervenes in terms of the government or the HSE, to get on top of this to be a scandal also. So, for example, we have 23 rehabilitation teams nationally after 10 years. That's less than 50%. There's supposed to be 46 to 48 teams nationally. We also have started, because of this and because of this lack of care that's being provided, the HSE has started using beds in specialist rehabilitation units, which are private units, which are based in Dublin and one in Cork. But the problem is, if you live in Donegal or you live in any other part of the country, you have to move away from your community to these placements, and these placements can be up for up to 3 years. The inspector quite clearly identifies that this isn't appropriate. This inappropriate out-of-area placement is pretty much being banned in the UK and being monitored in the UK, and yet we seem to, and I would say accidentally or unintentionally, seem to be driving this into our system. So that's something that we would want to cease immediately, and we've spoke to the HSE about this. Very often the responses you get are, well, you know, what can we do, or, you know, is there another way of doing it? That to me isn't acceptable as a regulator. I've heard that excuse for many years. The way that we want to see things done is that government policy is applied and applied properly. It's not an a la carte menu, and it's something that should be monitored by the department and people should be held accountable.
Being hospitalised with a mental health illness can often be a very traumatic experience for somebody and indeed their family. And the hope with a rehabilitation service is that once that's over, that a rehabilitation service can keep them out of an acute hospital again. Is the danger that with a gap in rehab services that there are more admissions than there need to be?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is basic health services management. The most costly thing is an acute bed in the hospital. If you don't look after someone in the community and apply the services, you will have this revolving door. And at this moment in time, there are people in units around this country in beds that don't need to be there because we do not have the community rehabilitation services. So it's bad for the patient, and that's the most important, but it's also bad for the public purse. And it just doesn't make any sense. It's quite perverse, actually, that after 10 years, and I think your listeners need to understand this, this is a 10-year-old policy. We'll have a new policy coming out soon, and from what I'm seeing is, a policy is just a piece of paper. It's absolutely useless unless it's implemented and monitored, and the only reason we're putting a policy there is for the citizen.
We'll be talking to the Minister for Health, Simon Harris, later in the programme, and he's just the latest minister since the Vision for Change was launched in 2006. Why do you think it hasn't been implemented properly?
I think there's a structural issue in Ireland about how the Department of Health monitors the implementation of our health services and the HSE. I think now that we have a HSE board, I think I'm hoping that the board members there will look at this and go, look, there's a strategic issue here where the most vulnerable who we're supposed to be caring for after 10 years are not getting the services they require. So for me, it's about the political system puts in place the policy with the help of the department, and then that's implemented by the public servants. And, you know, it's monitored and people actually check if it's happening. So the idea that we as regulators are coming along and we're producing this report, which I'm sure your listeners will be shocked about, that's just not good enough in a modern health service. A modern health service manages what's going on and really adapts and changes and makes sure that we're community-based.
Would it be expensive to implement the report in full?
Well, it's a lot more expensive to be blocking up all the beds, and it's very expensive on the people who need rehabilitation, who are losing years of their lives. I mean, you know, I'm at the age where I've listened to many vulnerable citizens talk about lost years in their lives, and I want to make sure that doesn't happen to people now in the mental health services.
John Farrelly, thanks for coming into us. That's John Farrelly, Chief Executive of the Mental Health Commission. It's 7:46.
Bones of a tiny amphibian-like creature which scurried around the shores of County Clare 325 million years ago have been discovered. The two bones come from a leg and possibly a hip bone from the small amphibian. They were found buried in the muddy seafloor near Doolan by geologist Dr. Eamon Doyle, who joins us now on the line. It's quite a discovery. Tell us about it.
Well, good morning, and from County Clare. Yeah, it's a great discovery. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the role of Clare County Council and Geological Survey of Ireland in supporting the geopark and supporting my role, without whom, you know, we wouldn't be finding these things. So the bones themselves, yeah, as you said, they are from a tiny little amphibian-like creature. And it comes from, the interest particularly comes from at this period of time, around 325 million years ago. It's at the time when animals were evolving from the sea to the land. So when fishes were evolving the ability to walk and to become what we now know as amphibians, lizards, and ultimately dinosaurs and ourselves. So when we can find extra little pieces of information about what they might have looked like at that time and their bones, it adds to our understanding, overall understanding of the evolution of all these creatures.
And how did you know, how do you know what these bones are?
Well, I'm a geologist, I'm a paleontologist, so I look at fossils all the time, so I guess that's my role. But also then I worked with Egon, a co-author, who's done a lot of work on early tetrapods, so we work together, and, you know, it comes to you know, experience, knowledge, and a lot of research.
So this little fellow, he predated the dinosaurs?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, by 100 million years or so. You know, so this is, you know, at that time we were in a kind of a swamp area by the sea, so he would have been, you know, crawling around on land, near rivers perhaps, near in estuaries, walking on land. We know he was able to walk on land, but he would have been able to swim as well, and ultimately then they would have evolved. And for example, you know, if you look at your hand or your toes, you've got five fingers, and we all take that for granted. And I guess unless you've got a young kid, they'll say, well, why do we have five fingers? And around this time was when that became fixed. You know, before that, or just around this time, before that 300-odd million years ago, some of these creatures had 6, 7, 8 toes and fingers. So understanding, you know, more information we have helps us understand how we become the way we are now.
325 million years ago, it's kind of hard to grasp. What was the world like then?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. One of the things about geology, you have to look and realise things were not the same. And this is one of the importance of geology, is because we know the Earth can change, it does change, how it's changed in the past, and that gives us clues to how it's going to change in the future. So yeah, the continents were completely different. There was no Ireland, there was no County Clare, there was no Europe. So all the continents were rearranged in a different position. They were mostly in the southern hemisphere, and they were all coming together to form one large continent, which we called Pangaea. So there was a lot of forestry at that time, not trees as we know now. There was a lot of different lycopods and different things, but it was a very lush vegetation across the land, and that influenced the climate. And then when these trees and died, they formed bogs and peats, and that was a carbon storage. So it was extracting carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And then, of course, 300 million years later, we dig up that coal, which has become, and we start burning that, and that puts the carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere, and there are subsequent changes that as a result of that. So it helps us understand what happened in the past and what may well happen in the future.
And what will happen to these little bones?
What will happen to them?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they'll be going to the Irish Museum of Natural History in Dublin. When we find something like this and describe it, we have to make it available to other researchers worldwide, locally or worldwide, who might be working on similar things and need to compare. So you can't just keep it in a private collection, keep it locked away. So they'll be available for the scientific community for further study.
All right. Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the line to tell us about the discovery this morning. That was Dr. Eamon Doyle.
Let's get a weather forecast for the time coming up to 4 minutes to eight. Jean Byrne is at Met Eireann. Morning, Jean.
Good morning. Well, changeable and unsettled weather continues coming in from the Atlantic all the time. So it'll bring a lot of cloud today with outbreaks of rain and drizzle extending from the west this morning. Some dry spells will develop in many areas in the afternoon, but it will remain dull and misty in places with hill and coastal fog. And then rain will become persistent in South Munster and South Leinster later this afternoon, and also in the west and northwest towards evening. Quite mild today with highs of 14 to 17 degrees and quite a windy day with moderate to fresh southwesterly winds. The winds will be strong in coastal areas. Tonight will be mostly cloudy at first with widespread rain and drizzle. Clearer conditions with scattered showers will develop in many parts, especially in the northern half of the country, but there'll be further outbreaks of rain in South Munster and South Leinster with some heavy bursts. Minimum temperatures 7 to 10 degrees. Tomorrow morning, the rain in the south and southeast will clear early on, and tomorrow will be a cool, breezy day with bright spells and scattered showers, most of the showers in the western half of the country. Cooler than today with maximum temperatures of 12 to 15 degrees in mostly moderate west to southwest winds. But the winds will be strong and gusty on north and northwest coasts. For the weekend, a lot of bright weather with sunny spells but scattered showers as well. Most of the showers in Atlantic coastal areas in the morning, extending further east during the day. Quite cool over the weekend with maximum temperatures of 12 to 15 on Saturday and about 12 to 14 on Sunday. The winds will be mostly light to moderate south to southwest. Then that unsettled trend continues into next week. Monday will have some bright spells but scattered showers as well, and there'll be further spells of rain in places, mainly in Ulster and North Leinster. Quite cool with highs of 10 to 13 degrees and light to moderate southerly winds at first on Monday, veering west to northwest and freshening. And then from Tuesday onwards, unsettled and changeable with wet and windy weather at times. But for today, mostly cloudy with outbreaks of rain and drizzle extending from the west through the morning. Some dry spells will develop in many areas this afternoon, but remaining dull and misty in some parts with hill and coastal fog. And rain will become persistent in South Munster and South Leinster later and also in the west and northwest. Highest temperatures 14 to 17. That's all from us at Met Eireann. Good morning.
Now, it's an industry that accounts for almost 2 billion euro in annual exports and supports around 40,000 jobs in the economy. Ireland's medical technology sector recorded export growth of around 7% last year. The sector is the focus of an Enterprise Ireland conference today. One of the companies participating is Galway-based CLS, Complete Laboratory Solutions, which is announcing an expansion today. Its founder and CEO, Evelyn O'Toole, is here now. Thanks for coming in to us, Evelyn. Before we take a look at the wider sector and your plans, you might tell us what CLS does.
Thanks, Brian. I'm the CEO of CLS, and we are a contract lab. We're in fact the largest privately owned contract lab in the country. We provide sampling and testing to the food, environmental, medical device and pharmaceutical industries. We also supply fully trained analysts and managed services into all of those client areas.
Now you're expanding your operations, you're taking on more staff. Why are you doing this and what kind of staff are you looking for?
So this is as a result of, again, the event on today, Made in Ireland, organised by Enterprise Ireland, is a big area for us, the medtech space, and that would account for almost 80 of the new jobs created out of our Galway-based plant, which is called CLS Med Pharma. We've also produced almost 20 jobs in Rasmuc, in our headquarters where it all started, in environmental and food. The core discipline that we're inviting to apply for these new positions are microbiology graduates and also analytical graduates.
Are you solely Ireland-based or are some of your clients based abroad?
So we've got 12% overseas business. This, a lot of this would come from our development and skills in the whole pre-market studies area.
And in terms of the operations, I'm wondering, is there a Brexit dividend perhaps, especially in terms of your plans for expansion?
So we see an upside on Brexit because unfortunately for UK-based companies from Brexit onwards, they won't be able to release their products into the EU without coming through a non-UK testing house like ourselves. So yes, we're seeing probably over the last 2 years a significant level of inquiry, and that's converting.
So that's interesting. A lot of operations might have gone to the UK, a lot of sampling and testing would have been done in the UK, but that, I suppose, has to either remain in Ireland now or go into mainland Europe, which poses potential difficulties in terms of the transport.
There are logistics involved, or extension to the current logistics for it to make for the UK guys to make this successful, to get around it. But Ireland is a choice, and we're open for business. We're scalable. Obviously, we're an English-speaking country. We're very close proximity as well. So I think there's a good upside here.
We had our budget on Tuesday, of course. Any measures in there that might assist the medtech sector?
Nothing very obvious to me from a business perspective. I guess I was very disappointed that the entrepreneurial relief wasn't looked at. Carbon tax obviously was a positive for our long-term future for everything. I would say probably the government are very focused on Brexit for the whole country's security, and I appreciate that.
Evelyn O'Toole, CEO and founder of CLS, thanks indeed for coming into us this morning. I'll have more business news at 8:30. Now it's back to Gavin.
France, Germany and the United Kingdom have called for a meeting of the United Nations Security Council to discuss Turkey's air and ground offensive on Kurdish-controlled areas in northeastern Syria. It follows the decision by the US President Donald Trump to withdraw his country's troops from the area. Mr. Trump has been criticised for his decision at home and abroad. One of his allies, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, said the US administration had, as he put it, shamelessly abandoned the Kurds. The US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has rejected other criticism that the withdrawal of troops paved the way for the Turkish military operation.
The United States didn't give Turkey a green light. We'll continue to be in a position to do what we need to do to keep the American people as safe as we possibly can from this threat. But it is not only in Syria. It emanates from Iraq. There are a dozen other countries where the threat from radical Islamic terrorism continues to exist, and we, the United States, has to make sure we position our forces, our resources appropriately to reduce that threat to the United States.
The Taoiseach Leo Varadkar is meeting the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson later today to try to break the deadlock over Brexit. The two leaders will hold what are described as private talks in northwest England. The exact location has not been made known. Our London correspondent Sean Whelan.
In the ether for the past fortnight, this meeting between Leo Varadkar and Boris Johnson has been billed in some UK media as last-ditch talks on possible changes to the Northern Ireland backstop that might just clear the way for a Brexit deal. If they don't, attempts to get a deal could be formally shut down by the weekend. Irish sources are not upbeat. Yesterday, the Taoiseach told the Dáil the government wants a deal and will work until the very last moment to get one. But, he added, not at any cost. The talks venue has been kept secret and there is no scheduled press conference, nor will there be any video of the meeting. Both leaders will be accompanied by senior officials for the talks, and Michel Barnier's team in Brussels will be kept fully informed. Sean Whelan, RTE News, London.
The Inspector of Mental Health Services, Dr. Susan Finnerty, has said it's astounding that the state has failed to provide adequate rehabilitation services in the sector. Dr. Finnerty blamed the long-term neglect of people with severe and enduring mental illness for creating a revolving door admissions practice to the detriment of service users, their families and the public finances. Our religious and social affairs correspondent, Joe Little.
The inspector's report on rehabilitation and recovery in the HSE's mental health services states that the HSE has 23 rehabilitation teams. That's just under half what official policy requires, and that those dedicated, creative and hardworking teams are staffed at just over one-third of their recommended levels. She notes that the inaccessibility of rehabilitation services deprives people with enduring mental illness of any prospect of reaching their full potential, and that individuals facing these challenges expressed frustration and anger at being stuck in an unresponsive system. She blames the state's long-term neglect of rehabilitation for the repeated admissions of such people to inpatient units, followed by discharges and readmissions when things break down again, a pattern she describes as counterproductive for both the people concerned and the already severely under-resourced acute psychiatric services.
The search for a fisherman missing in West Cork has resumed. The alarm was raised when the fisherman failed to return to port in West Cork yesterday evening. Two games have been cancelled at the Rugby World Cup in Japan. The England-France and the New Zealand-Italy matches have been called off because of Typhoon Hagibis. Tournament rules state that any pool game that cannot be played is not rescheduled and instead is recorded as a 0-0 draw, giving each team 2 points with no bonus points available. Ireland's match against Samoa has not been affected. From Japan, our sports reporter Justin Tracy.
The two games to go, England and France and New Zealand and Italy, are both in the path of Super Typhoon Hagibis. It's due to hit Japan on Saturday, affecting Yokohama and Toyota, the two venues. Tournament director Alan Gilpin said they looked exhaustively at contingency plans, which involved moving or rearranging matches. But it was decided it was unfeasible on both logistical and safety grounds. Organisers say they hope the Japan-Scotland game, also in Yokohama, will be able to go ahead on Sunday. A decision on this will be taken on Sunday morning, 6 hours before the game. But were it to be cancelled and the game called a draw, Scotland would be out, barring Ireland lost, without a bonus point. Justin Tracy, RTE News, Japan.
Now the time is coming up to 6:08.
RTE Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks. Working on a construction site? Stay clear of overhead wires and underground cables. For emergencies, call 1850 372 999.
It'll be generally cloudy today. Outbreaks of rain and drizzle will extend from the west during the morning. There'll be dry spells in many areas this afternoon, but it'll be dull and misty in many areas with hill and coastal fog. Rain will become persistent in South Munster and South Leinster later this afternoon and in the west and northwest towards evening. Highest temperatures will range from 14 to 17 degrees. And there's a warning that southwesterly winds will reach gale force later today and tonight on coastal waters from Slinehead to Rossonpoint to Fairhead.
The controversy over the payment of protection money to criminals at building sites in Dublin, how a no-deal Brexit could impact on our fishing industry, and an online spat between two footballers' wives are some of the stories on your front pages this morning. The Examiner takes the line that senior bosses at Dublin City Council are under increasing pressure to explain if they knew about the payments made to criminals at building sites in Cherry Orchard. The Herald, meanwhile, publishes a front-page story, which the paper ran 3 years ago, revealing that a council probe was underway at the time into claims that a criminal mob was providing security at a West Dublin site. This was the first I heard about it. That's a lead headline in today's Irish Daily Mail, which quotes comments made by Housing Minister Owen Murphy during an interview on RTÉ Radio yesterday in relation to the controversy. In its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Daily Mirror quotes comments made by Fine Gael councillor Danny Byrne, comparing the controversy to something straight out of the Mafia. The Irish Independent leads today with details of a confidential document thought to have come from Taoiseach the Simon Coveney, warning that a no-deal Brexit could impact on the Irish fishing industry and lead to panic buying amongst consumers. The budget allocation of €110 million to the agricultural sector in the event of a no-deal Brexit provides the lead story in the Irish Farmers Journal. Backstop battle as time runs out. That's the lead headline in the Belfast Telegraph in relation to today's meeting between the Taoiseach and the British Prime Minister. Donald Trump's defence of his decision to withdraw American troops as Turkey began its military incursion into northeast Syria yesterday provides the lead story in today's Irish Times. For its lead story, the Irish Star reports today that convicted rapist Patrick O'Brien was rushed to hospital from prison yesterday. The Irish News leads with the sudden death of the former manager of Down GAA, Eamon Burns, at the age of 56. And the Irish Sun leads with Wayne Rooney's wife Colleen's post on Instagram yesterday, in which she claimed that the personal stories leaked about her to the Sun newspaper had come from an account owned by Rebecca Vardy, wife of Jamie Vardy, after she'd conducted an online sting operation in which she posted fake stories on her personal account. Wags at War is a headline related to that story in the front of the Mail and Star. It's Wagro in the Sun and Rudunnett in the Independent. Elsewhere this morning, AIB is to sell off thousands of distressed mortgages. That's on the front of today's Times. As is a story about how three Irish nuns who stopped receiving their pensions after they moved back to Ireland from Portugal, having worked with disadvantaged people there for decades, have had their payments reinstated following an intervention by the Ombudsman. The Data Protection Commissioner has received a complaint from Dublin man Martin McMahon claiming that the collection of data from his travel pass is a form of mass surveillance. That's on the front of the Examiner. And a number of today's papers report on an American bird which was swept across the Atlantic during Storm Lorenzo and ended up in a County Kerry garden but died 30 minutes after completing its journey. The alternative fashion show staged by Extinction Rebellion protesters outside Penny's on O'Connell Street yesterday also receives lots of coverage today. And finally, the Examiner and a number of other papers report today on an invite which the Metropole Hotel in Cork has issued to couples who got married at the hotel in the past 50 years to attend a wedding club event tomorrow. Amongst the 400 guests who will be there are Joan Barrett, Sheila Fitzgerald and Breda O'Neill, who all worked at the Sunbeam factory and got married at the hotel on the same day 46 years ago. The Examiner runs with the shot taken of the three friends on the staircase of the hotel on their wedding day in 1973 and an updated picture of them looking every bit as lovely today.
With time running out to strike a Brexit deal, the Taoiseach will travel to England this morning for talks with the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Britain is due to leave the EU in 3 weeks' time. As of last night, there was no sign of a breakthrough, with the EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, saying it was not currently possible to reach agreement. Our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham, is on the line with more. Paul, officially, we don't know where this meeting is taking place. Why all the secrecy?
Well, it has been described as a private meeting, so rather than a bilateral with the media being invited and statements before the two men go in to have the meeting, just like in Dublin, this is something far more quiet. And I guess it reflects the fact that things are very serious. We are just 1 week out from a European Council meeting where prime ministers and presidents were hoping to arrive and sign off on a Brexit deal, but things look too far away for that to happen. And on that basis, the UK has decided if there is going to be a meeting, then it would be best just for the prime ministers plus five advisers to meet in a room away from the glare of the media and try and see if it's possible to secure a deal. As Sean Whelan was saying in the report at the top of the programme, some in the UK media are talking this up as a last-ditch effort to secure a deal, where the Irish media are far more downbeat about the expectations that can come from it.
The government here has always said that any deal would be negotiated by the EU, not through bilateral discussions. So what will be the focus of this meeting?
It was still the European Union which conducts these negotiations under Michel Barnier and the Brexit Task Force. But I guess what you have is two leaders sounding each other out about what might be possible. We are still the closest neighbours. If there is not going to be a deal, we will still be the closest neighbours. And to a certain extent, this is just a sounding out about what might be possible. I think it's also taking place against a backdrop of where the possibility of a no deal is getting greater and greater. As I understand it, the Cabinet did receive an update on what might the consequences of a no deal might be today. They've received these updates regularly, but this one focused on the most vulnerable sectors and what might happen and how would the state respond, what contingency efforts are there. So the negotiations taking place today between Boris Johnson and Leo Varadkar are in that context where the no deal is getting larger and larger as that deadline of October the 31st gets closer and closer.
How much do we know about the nitty-gritty? What will be the focus of the discussions?
Well, we do know that the UK made proposals, and initially the EU response was sort of constructive and polite, but they didn't go into the tunnel, into an intensive phase, because they felt the British proposals didn't go far enough. Now, since then, the UK hasn't moved much more than the initial proposal, and what we saw in the European Parliament yesterday was Michel Barnier effectively dissecting the British proposal and restating that in his view the proposals currently, a deal isn't possible because the proposals don't go far enough. And I think what we have are the clear fault lines. One is that under the UK proposal, the Northern Ireland remains inside the UK customs, and we also have the Democratic Unionist Party having effectively a vote or a lock over any proposal every few years. And the European technical discussions which have been taking place in Brussels have been looking at that, but they seem to have run out of road. So unless there is something new introduced by the UK today, it looks as if what we're going to be talking about really is wrapping up these discussions. Are going to be closing down, and we're moving into a question of it's either going to be an extension sought by the UK at the European Council meeting, or we don't know what.
As we move closer to that deadline, there has been an increasing focus on blame, with all sides essentially seeking to blame the other side.
Yeah, I mean, if you looked at the European Parliament, we also had Jean-Claude Juncker, the President of the European Commission, and he was responding to some UK media reports saying that Europe wasn't going to get involved in a blame game, but in the next sentence saying, if there is any blame, it lies with London. Certainly we had over the past number of days briefings from Number 10, which suggested that it was the EU which is being intransigent, the UK had moved, the EU wasn't going to reciprocate, and on that basis, if things went south, it was going to be the fault of the European Union. So when you see the blame game beginning to bubble up, some strident comments from Arlene Foster, the leader of the Democratic Unionist Party, it's a clear indication that things are not going the right way.
Paul, thanks indeed. Paul Cunningham there, our political correspondent, at 19 minutes past 8.
Minister for Health Simon Harris is in our city centre studio. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, Gavin. Thank you for having me.
We'll talk to you about your campaign to promote the winter flu jab shortly, but first to that meeting in England today. What does the Taoiseach want from this meeting?
Well, I think it's right and proper that the Taoiseach takes every opportunity to engage with everybody and anybody who has a relevance to the European Council meeting that will take place next week. The British Prime Minister has invited the Taoiseach to England today to meet to discuss Brexit in advance of the European Council next week. I think it's an opportunity for the two men to check in, to share views in relation to where we're at, and most importantly for the Taoiseach to reiterate the Irish position, which has been remarkably consistent over the last 3 years in relation to what it would require to get a Brexit deal. And we've been very consistent in relation to this. The Irish position has not changed. The British position may have. Getting a deal is going to be extremely difficult, but not impossible. And I think it's entirely appropriate that the Taoiseach continues to engage with everyone and anyone that he can in the run-up to the European Council.
Does your government trust Boris Johnson?
Boris Johnson is the elected Prime Minister of the UK, and of course we trust the UK political system in that regard. It's not for us to choose the UK Prime Minister, and to be quite frank, whoever the UK Prime Minister is, whoever is in power or not in power in Britain, our position has never changed in relation to Brexit. So the consistency that the Irish government, and in fairness that the Michel Barnier task force has brought to the issue of Brexit, can leave no British Prime Minister in any doubt as to what it will require to get a deal.
The flu jab, plenty of people have already had the vaccine so far. You're encouraging more people to take it up, and in particular healthcare workers, only half of whom were vaccinated last year. Are those that don't putting the public at risk?
Quite frankly, yes. You're quite right. I am here today to encourage everybody to take up the flu vaccine, particularly those in vulnerable categories. We see about 200 to 500 deaths each and every year from the flu. So this is not the common cold. It's not, you know, the man flu that sometimes people joke about. This is a deadly illness that kills up to 500 people in our country every year. We have seen very significant increases in the uptake rate for both over 65s and also for healthcare professionals. Last year, about 53% of healthcare professionals got the flu vaccine. That's up about 10% on the previous year, but it's nowhere near high enough. So this morning I'll be meeting with healthcare professionals from across the country, encouraging them in their own hospitals and in their own community organisations to put in place plans to make sure that that rate increases further. This is a vaccine that can save lives. And this year we have a new vaccine that protects you from four strains of the flu compared to the previous vaccine that protected you from three strains.
Yes. How do you know that this year's vaccine will work?
It's a very good question, Gavin, because as you know well, the strain of flu can vary each year. And quite frankly, until the flu arrives in our country, we can never be 100% certain how perfect a match the vaccine is for the current strain. But I have medical advice that suggests that this vaccine does deal with all of the most common types of flu. We've seen in Australia already the main type of flu this year being influenza A, and this vaccine is an excellent match in that regard. And often the trend for flu here in our own country can follow what's happened in other parts of the world.
We were talking to John Farrelly of the Mental Health Commission earlier in the programme after a report by the Inspector of Mental Health Services, where she found that the state had failed to astounding effect, in her own words, to provide proper and in many cases any follow-up services to very ill people coming out of hospital. Do you accept her findings, and why aren't you implementing your own policy here?
So I fully accept her findings, and I want to thank her for her work. It's so important, particularly on World Mental Health Day, that we have regulators and commissions constantly urging everyone to do better in this regard. I think, though, that the Mental Health Commission, and indeed any objective analysis, would show that we have made significant progress in the area of mental health in a number of places. So can I point out, Gavin, that the budget for mental health is now €1 billion for the first time ever. We've seen a 20% reduction in the waiting times for child and adolescent mental health services, a very, very important issue. We're opening our new mental health hospital in Port Arran next year, and we will have a new Vision for Change updated policy document being brought to Cabinet by Minister Jim Daly by the end of the year. But that does not take away from absolutely the need to act on the Mental Health Commission's findings, and I look forward to meeting them in the coming weeks as we prepare the HSE Service Plan 2020 to see how we can make real and tangible progress.
Susan Finnerty says, we have people trapped in the acute system of inpatient mental health care because the services are not in place for them to be discharged. She says others are left with families, often with ageing parents, who cannot provide the support and care needed. A plan that's 13 years old, which is only half done in relation to rehabilitation services. Why are you not implementing your own policy?
So I think we are, Gavin, but do we have more to do? We do indeed.
It's only half done in the space of 13 years.
Yeah, and in Susan's report, she rightly talks about decades of neglect in this area, which we've been working extremely hard in the 3 years that I've been Health Minister to catch up in this area. This year alone, in 2019, we're spending €6 million extra in the very area that the Commission rightly highlights in terms of putting new rehabilitative training, rehabilitative places in place right across the country. And also, as we open Port Arran, we do need to remember, Gavin, we're moving from an outdated institution that belongs in the history books in Dundrum in terms of the physical infrastructure to a new state-of-the-art hospital in Port Arran, which will not just
I wasn't asking about rehabilitation services, and you said that there is €6 million extra for that this year when parts of the country have no rehabilitation services at all. €6 million when your government is still giving €17 million to greyhounds.
And can I just, the reason I was talking about Port Arran was not because it's going to be a brand new building, but with that building is coming a new model of care which will enable people to actually have rehabilitation before actually just being returned to community services. So a new level of support. I'm not saying all we're doing is €6 million. I'm saying €6 million extra has been spent in 2019. And I'm saying as we prepare the HSE service plan for 2020, we will prioritise this area. We will do more. And I'll be meeting the Mental Health Commission to examine what practical steps we can take in the immediate term.
When your party came to power almost a decade ago, there was a promise of free GP care for all within 5 years. Now the plan is to roll that out to 500,000 people a year, starting with people on lower incomes. That was the Sláinte Care plan. And this week, the plan is to give GP care to 6 and 7 year olds and give another 50,000 medical cards to better off pensioners. It's just a drop in the ocean, isn't it?
Well, it's a 10-year plan. As you rightly say, the policy direction for health has now been agreed for the first time ever. We've achieved something in this country that we've never done before. We've gotten every political party in the Dáil to sign up to Sláinte Care, a clear reform plan for the health service that will transform Ireland's health service over the next decade. Yes, you're right, we have to start somewhere. I think it would be entirely inappropriate to flood GPs with lots and lots and lots of extra work without supporting them in the way they need to. That's why I've agreed a new GP contract measures. 95% of GPs, Gavin, voted in favour of that. And what I said when I sat down with GPs was, I intend to extend free GP care to all children under 12, and we would do it on a phased basis, starting with 6 and 7 year olds next year. But GPs need to be resourced properly to do this, and I need to engage with them on the appropriate fee. So we have a long way to go to get to where we need to in relation to universal healthcare. I'm very clear that I want to bring in universal healthcare in this country, and we now have a roadmap called Sláinte Care to get us there.
Your party was promising to do it in one term of power. Is it going to take three or more?
I believe it's going to take 10 years to deliver Sláinte Care, and we're now in year two. But I do also think when people talk about you know, Fine Gael and the length of time we've been in government, I do think it's important to acknowledge that the first 3 or 4 years of that were completely written off due to the economic mismanagement of this country by Fianna Fáil.
Your party put forward that plan, mindful of finances at the time, to promise GP care for all within 5 years.
And since then, in a minority government, we've sat down with the opposition and agreed the timelines in which it is appropriate in a realistic way to arrive there. And I'm very satisfied that that's a good plan. It's a plan that I absolutely advocate for and work to every day. And you saw in Budget 2020 a number of concrete steps forward in that regard, where there was 1,000 more frontline staff, including speech and language therapists, physios and others in the community, reducing prescription charges or providing more medical cards to our older citizens, or free dental care and free GP care to our children. I think these are real tangible steps forward.
If you're really committed to universal healthcare, will you legislate for entitlement to care as was set out in the Sláinte Care report?
Yes, I believe we will, but we'll do so in the appropriate sequence. There's no point legislating for something until it can absolutely be delivered. We need to build up the capacity in the public health service first. We need to reform the way our doctors are working in the health service. I'd love to have a chance to talk to you about the Donald Butler report at some point, which talks about how private practice in public hospitals is completely out of step with best international practice. We need to make sure we build up the workforce in the community. That's what Budget 2020 was about, with 1,000 extra staffs. And when we have those measures in place, absolutely we should legislate. I'm 100% committed to universal healthcare and to Sláinte Care, but I also believe in telling the truth. It is a journey that's going to take 10 years, but now it's a journey that's well underway.
Are you going to put money forward to implement the De Butler report and take private patients out of public hospitals?
Absolutely, it's going to require money. And as we sit down with our consultants, I'd like to do two things. I'd like to talk about what we can do immediately to address their legitimate grievances about recruitment and retention. And that does include engaging on the issue of pay parity. And then phase two of any talks has to be about what a new consultant contract looks like. And yes, that will require more funding. But Gavin, it'll also require an end to business as usual. It's not just about free money for doing the same stuff. It's about doing things differently. It's about recognising that it's wrong that when there are patients on trolleys in our hospitals, private practice is continuing in public beds unabated. And if we're serious about health reform, we can't just do the fluffy things. We've got to actually do the real tough decisions here, and I'm well up for that.
You said free money for doing the same stuff. They would say that there's a clear pay inequality where some of them are working for 50 grand less than their colleagues doing the same job. Are you going to reverse that pay cut?
I believe, and I said at the IMO conference in April, that pay parity is a real issue and I want to see it addressed. So as we sit down with our
consultants... Are you going to reverse it?
As we sit down to engage with the IMO next week, that will be an issue and I want to see it. I want to see it addressed. I absolutely want to see it addressed. You'll understand why I'm not going to negotiate on the airwaves. But I'd also make the point, when we sat down with nurses and midwives, when we sat down with GPs and we agreed new contracts and new ways of doing things, we put more money into those services. But we also asked them to do things differently and they stepped up to the plate in that regard. Consultants will need to do the same.
I'll get some news headlines in just a moment. Can you promise that the HSE will not have a supplementary budget next year?
I think it's almost impossible to promise that any health service in any part of the world will come in exactly on budget. What I can promise is that the trend that Paul Reid has started, the new CEO of the health service, of really having a good financial grip on the organisation will continue and be enhanced. That means, yes, we'll increase the number of staff working in the health service, just like we have this year, but we won't do it in a way where individual managers can run around making hiring decisions that aren't aligned with priorities in terms of public health policy. So I'm satisfied that Paul Reid will continue to build on the progress he's made.
Minister for Health Simon Harris, thank you for speaking to us this morning. It's 8:30.
A host of statistical indicators are due to be published today. In the UK, growth figures for August should give an indication as to whether the economy is heading for a technical recession. Here, property price figures for August are being published. The July figure saw prices in the capital falling for the first time in 7 years. Inflation data for September will also be published later. The fate of Ballymena-based Wrightbus is expected to be known in the coming hours. The business was put up for sale last month after it was placed into administration. A bidder has come forward, but there were issues over the ownership of the factory site. A deadline for a resolution passes this morning. And Apple has removed a map application from its store that was widely used by pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. It was removed following a claim from China's state media that it helps rioters. Apple said it had verified that the app was being used to target and ambush police. Currencies, the euro is trading at $1.10 and 90 pence sterling.
Damien O'Mara has arrived. Morning, Damien.
Gavin, good morning to you. Shortly, details of the hurling championship fixtures for 2020. But first off, the Irish head coach Joe Smith has made 12 changes to his starting lineup to face Samoa in Pool A at Rugby World Cup on Saturday. Just Keith Earls, Jonathan Sexton and Tadhg Byrne are retained from the side which beat Russia this day last week. Robbie Henshaw has also been past fit and will make his first appearance of the tournament.
The team to play Samoa, hopefully this weekend, is Kian Healy, Rory Best captain, Tadhg Furlong, Ian Henderson and James Ryan in the second row, Tadhg Byrne, Josh van der Fleer, CJ Stander, Connor Murray, Jonathan Sexton, Jacob Stockdale and Keith Earls on the wings, with Bundy Aki and Robbie Henshaw in the midfield and Jordan Lama at fullback. The replacements are Niall Scannell, Dave Kilcoyne, Andrew Porter, Jean Klein, Peter O'Mahony, Luke McGrath, Joey Carberry and Andrew Conway.
Ahead of that game, and for the first time in 9 stagings of Rugby World Cup, tournament organisers have been forced to cancel games. Saturday's meeting of England and France in Pool C and the game between New Zealand and Italy in Pool B have now been recorded as scoreless draws. The decision has been taken because of the dangers to public safety posed by the super typhoon Hagibis to the Tokyo, Yokohama and Toyota regions. England now progresses pool winners ahead of France. New Zealand will top their pool ahead of South Africa. A decision will be made on Sunday morning local time about playing the game between Japan and Scotland in Ireland's pool later on that afternoon. All 3 teams could still progress to the knockout stages. A bonus point win for Ireland on Saturday would bring with it a quarter-final place irrespective of the Japan-Scotland game going ahead. Former Irish international Paddy Wallace is with me. Paddy, I suppose first off, disappointment for a lot of people that these games have been cancelled, but tournament organisers have to urge on the cause the side of safety.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, there's a lot of waking up this morning, it's a lot of information to process. 2 great games, unfortunately, for the fans that they're going to miss out on. England-France was set up to be a cracker and unfortunately not be going ahead. It's the first time in a World Cup that this has actually happened, so it's a lot to process. Mm. But I think from an Irish point of view, all eyes will be on the match that they'll be playing against Samoa, and of course whether or not the Japanese game goes ahead.
But I suppose from an Irish player's perspective, the focus remains securing a bonus point, secure your progression, and you now know if you win your pool you face South Africa, if you finish runner-up you face New Zealand.
Yeah, I suppose our destiny's in our own hands still. But we certainly need to improve on our performance levels that we've shown in the last 2 games to do that against Samoa, who are going to be a very tough opposition to go out and get a win, never mind a bonus point. So and I think Joe's named his, I think in his eyes, his strongest side to do that. And it's going to take a level of performance that is that we haven't seen in the last two games to record that.
Just a word on that. A nine-day turnaround. The players had last weekend off. They effectively went back into camp on Sunday evening. So it's as close to a standard test week as they would have. Does that bring you confidence that we'll get a renewed level of performance that we know this squad are capable of?
I think in the last two games it really... It's been really quite unsettling how far the performance has dipped in comparison to that Scottish game. I think after the Scottish game, you know, we thought Ireland were back to that form that they showed in 2018 and were warranting their number one team in the world ranking. Now, the level of performance has dipped considerably. And we've been waiting for these last two games for a reaction to that, and we didn't get that really in the Russia game. We took care of business, but there was a lot of change in personnel. We didn't have our first team out, so I think, you know, Joe's gone to his strongest lineup, and with all the pressure that has come down on this team, I really do expect that reaction and that level of performance to rise considerably and to cut out a lot of those basic errors that have dogged this World Cup campaign so far. I really do expect a reaction. I expect four tries. I expect a bonus point. I expect us to go through to the quarterfinals.
Paddy, thanks very much for that. Finishing on a positive note, Paddy Wallace, former Irish international, with us there. Radio coverage of the game on Saturday is on 2FM. Television coverage over on RTE1. In Gaelic Games, the appointment of a new hurling manager in Clare has been delayed following a meeting of their county board last night. Neither the name of Louis Mulqueen or Brian Lohan was put to clubs for ratification. Both had been interviewed for the job on Monday. The process has now been extended until a meeting on October 21st. All this week here on Morning Ireland, we have hosted the draws for the Provincial Football Championships. And today we turn our attention to the hurling fixtures for 2020 with the details. Here's Darren Frehel.
Tipperary, All-Ireland champions for the 28th time.
All-Ireland champions Tipperary opened their 2020 Munster campaign with a trip to Limerick on the 10th of May. Cork and Munster champions Limerick clash on the same weekend. Again, some teams will face more demanding schedules than others. Both Clare and Cork will play the final three rounds on consecutive weekends in the space of 14 or 15 days. Changing the system has been rejected. Liam Lenehan, chairman, Munster GAA, explains why.
Everything was considered this year. If we changed to the Leinster model, you would only have two games in a row. But look, all five counties came back and they said they wanted the draw that was there. I'd say it was to make room for the club championships as well. Goes round. The draw is done from 2018 to 2022, and everybody gets the three games at some stage or another. So the counties consider it, and they said it was fair.
There it is! It's all over! Do you know what? They'll be dancing at the crossroads tonight!
After a bye on the opening weekend, Wexford will open the defence of their title on the weekend of the 16th and 17th of May. Newly promoted Laois will take on Galway on the weekend of the 9th and 10th. The big debate in Leinster is whether their competition should be expanded. Jim Bulger is Leinster chairman.
Increasing to six was bandied about. We also looked at two groups of four at one stage. So perhaps that's something for the future. But I do feel that six would work for us. But we have to be careful that we don't undermine the McDonagh and the other competitions underneath as well. We have to look at the entire structure, not just the Bob O'Keefe, if you like, stroke McCarthy. We have to look at the effect bringing additional teams into that would have down the line as well.
Full details of next summer's fixtures in the Lee McCarthy, Joe McDonagh, Christy Ring, Nicky Rackard and Laurie Marr competitions have been published on the GAA and RT websites.
So fans can start planning for next summer. In soccer, Mick McCarthy's senior Republic of Ireland squad travelled to Tbilisi today ahead of Saturday's Euro 2020 qualifier with Georgia. There was a boost yesterday with Shane Duffy travelling with the squad. He had initially been a doubt with a calf problem. McCarthy is already without the injured Richard Keogh and the suspended Enda Stevens. The Republic's under-21s are in action tonight. They host Italy in Tala in Group 1 of Euro 2021 qualifying. Stephen Kenny's side have a maximum 9 points from their three games. Italy have won the only game they've played so far. Kickoff there is at 8:05. And two Irish boxers will fight for medals at the Women's World Amateur Boxing Championships in Russia. Lightweight Amy Broadhurst and welterweight Christina Desmond fight in quarterfinals just after midday. Victory will guarantee them at least a bronze medal. A reminder, sports news available as always throughout the day on the RTE News Now app and also on the RTE Sport website, Rachel.
A search operation has resumed after a fisherman failed to return to port in West Cork last night. The Valentia Coast Guard was alerted after the man failed to arrive as scheduled at 6 o'clock. Joining us now is John Draper, who's the Division Controller at the Valencia Coast Guard Coordination Centre. John, thanks for talking to us this morning. What's happening at the moment?
Rachel, at the moment, the search has stood up this morning again, just after first light. Local Coast Guard units from Golin and from Skull are searching the shoreline. We have the Rescue 115 is due on scene to conduct an aerial search of the area. And the WB Yates, the name of vessel WB Yates, along with local fishing vessels and the Castletown Bear lifeboat are doing a seaward search then. So there is a debris field in around the area between there's two islands there, Carberry Island and the Furze Island, and going back in on the southern shore, which has been concentrated on at the moment.
And when was the alarm raised last night?
The alarm would have been raised at about 8:30 p.m. and the young fisherman, the name of the vessel is the fishing vessel Tommy Orr. He would have been out since 6:30 in the morning, so he was fishing for he was hand lining for a pollock in the Dunmanis Bay area, around that area, we understand.
What are conditions like this morning?
Conditions are in around force 4 to 5. The lifeboat and the fishing vessels are able to conduct searches well enough at the moment. But conditions are likely to disimprove later on in the later morning and afternoon. And there's a small craft warning and there's a gale warning in operation.
Well, we wish you good luck. John, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. John Draper there.
Could children teach their farming families how to be safe on farms? That's the aim of a programme put together by one of the winners of the 2019 Social Entrepreneur Awards, who get €20,000 to fund their work. Alma Jordan is the founder of AgriKids, and she's here now. Alma, you're very welcome to Morning Ireland with your award.
Absolutely. Hasn't been out of my sight since.
Tell us about AgriKids. What is it?
AgriKids is a farm safety educational platform for children. I started it in 2015. In 2014, we had a horrendous year for farm accidents in Ireland. In fact, it was a record-breaking year. We lost 30 people that particular year, and 5 of those were children. So it was really the deaths of 2 children in August of that year. They were just 3 and 5 years of age. That really had a huge impact on me, because I'm a farmer's wife and daughter and sister, and I had a little boy of 2, and I said, how am I going to keep my family safe? Because it could be any of us. So I went looking to see what resources were available, and I became a little bit frustrated with what I found. I found them to be not relevant, and I found them to be a little bit outdated, and I said, you know what, we could do better. So I began to focus on children, because with work I'd done through the Green Schools programme, I really saw how effective children were with bringing social issues, we'll say, from a classroom setting and bringing them home. And I said, if children can be that passionate about, you know, recycling and reducing waste, definitely farming could be a way to go. And that's when I decided to create the storybooks, the gaming apps, and the workshop programme, which I do in schools throughout the country.
Tell us about the schools programme.
The schools programme is something that kind of came about very organically. I was approached by a librarian to do a reading in a local library, and after the reading I was asked to do a workshop, and the workshop then grew to be school based, and I focus on everything from slurry to animal behaviours to the different signage we might use on our farms, and I really get the children to interact with it. So I focus largely, we'll say, on infants up to six class, and I get the children to, I suppose, give back to me as much as I give out. So far we've reached over 24,000 children with these workshops. They're supported by Zurich Dow. So it's been an absolute, I've never once advertised the fact that I do these workshops. They are included on the national school curriculum, and they haven't really been serviced in a way that's been effective. So for me to be able to go into a school to talk to a children about how a bull might behave before attacking, or the danger surrounding slurry, they're bringing that message home. And they're bringing it home to a farming household. And not only that, but they're creating a conversation within the home. So for me, it's all about bringing the farm safety conversation into our homes and classrooms and communities, and not waiting until we pass the farm gate.
As any farmer will know who has a child who likes hanging around while they're doing their work, they can, you know, I mean, they're great company, and they can ask a lot of questions. And as teachers, they can be pretty persistent.
Oh, we used to coin a phrase called pester power. And I know for me, I did an event in Donegal not that long ago, and we were talking about PTO safety and the importance of covering a PTO and why. And a little girl put her
PTO,
hand up.
PTO, sorry.
It's a power takeoff device that goes onto the back of the tractor to power a piece of equipment.
Oh, yes, the terrifying ads.
Absolutely.
The radio for
it. It can rotate anywhere between 9 and 16 times a second. And this little girl put up her hand to say, my daddy doesn't have one of those in his PTO. And I said to her straight away, I said, well, what are we going to do about that? And she says, well, his birthday is coming up. Maybe I'll buy him one for his birthday. So that for me was an absolutely beautiful moment, because that little girl went home. And you know what? I'll never know if I've prevented a death or an accident, but I'd like to think that that conversation happened and that action was taken. And that proactive approach is what's going to create a safer future on our farms.
Loads of information on the AgriKids website, including apps and games. Alma Jordan, founder of AgriKids, thank you very much for coming into our studio this morning. 8:53.
Forget Brexit, forget the budget, forget Donald Trump. There was one subject dominating social media yesterday. On Twitter, it quickly became known as Wagatha Christie. And for this morning's papers, it has provided a bonanza of puns from Waggy Leaks to Wagro. The story at the centre of this, a claim by one English footballer's wife, or Wag, Colleen Rooney, that someone using the Instagram account of another footballer's wife, Rebecca Vardy, had been leaking stories about her to The Sun. On Britain's Channel 4 News last night, they recreated the social media post in which Mrs. Rooney revealed her sting.
For a few years now, someone who I trusted to follow me on my personal Instagram account has been consistently informing the Sun newspaper of my private posts and stories. I've saved and screenshotted all the original stories, which clearly show just one person has viewed them. It's Rebecca Vardy's account.
And here's a short excerpt from Rebecca Vardy's response.
I'm so upset that you have chosen to do this, especially when I'm heavily pregnant. I'm disgusted that I'm even having to deny this.
RTE multimedia journalist Sinead Brennan is here. Sinead, Colleen Rooney, she's quite the detective, hence the Wagatha Christie moniker. What did she do?
So apparently she put in 5 months of investigative time into figuring out who it was that was leaking these stories about her. So I don't know how many accounts she tried out with this method she went down, but she blocked everyone else apart from Rebecca Vardy's account and then took screenshots to show that only that account had seen these stories that she had made up.
Now, the stories, I mean, they were hardly earth-shattering, but they were all in the newspapers, or in The Sun, rather, in particular.
Yeah, so there was one about her basement leaking, there was one about a supposed return to television, and one about her going to Mexico for a gender program thing. I'm not actually 100% sure what that one was.
Presumably, I think it was. Was it to do with that she might try and choose the gender?
That was it, yeah.
If she was having another child, because I think she has, what is it, 4 sons?
Yeah.
So Rebecca Vardy, Colleen Rooney put this up on her Instagram and her Twitter yesterday that she had uncovered what was going on. Rebecca Vardy responded pretty quickly.
She did, to try to clear her name and say like she had no part in this whatsoever. She revealed that she'd already spoken to Colleen about it on the phone, and she was saying, you know, you shouldn't have put this out there privately. I mean, publicly, when we've already spoken about it privately. And she was saying that, you know, she's heavily pregnant, she doesn't need the stress, she doesn't need the money, so why would she have done it? And apparently she has now hired forensic investigators to get to the bottom of if someone could have hacked her account.
Forensic investigators. Then the deluge started. The sheer volume of comments, a lot of them, it has to be said, very witty on Twitter yesterday, was quite something.
I think Twitter is made for days like yesterday. It just shows how funny people can be, and it's really the break everyone needed from Brexit. So it was good to focus everyone else's attention on something a little bit lighter, because it is pure kind of soap opera gossip, but in real life. So people couldn't believe it. Like, even Netflix got involved. One of their tweets was my favourite. It was, we're going to have to make a documentary about this, aren't we? And people were, you know, pulling up other stories about Wayne and Colleen Rooney and saying, you know, was this true, or were they just having Rebecca Vardy on? And these kinds of things. There was a lot of like visual memes too that were fantastic. But I thought another great one was her Wikipedia page was very quickly updated to call her an amateur detective.
The And that there's so much stuff in the papers this morning. And I suppose what we have really here is a perfect combination of celebrity, of old media, so-called, in the form of The Sun, and of new media, because really this all comes back down to Colleen Rooney's Instagram account.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll just be interested to see how it all goes out. I think everyone's going to be following this story because, like you said, there is so many factors at play, but it just came so out of the blue as well. And I think the way she even wrote her thing describing what had gone on was so well done. It had like a twist and their big reveal, and it really just, you know, you were reading through wondering what was going to happen.
Well, this is it. I mean, I know a lot of people are saying, as we've been saying, that Colleen Rooney should be a detective, but you'd have to think that there's a bit of a writer in her ear as well, because she wrote that Instagram post. It was, as you say, it was like a short story with a reveal in the final two words.
That's it. It was absolutely brilliant. It was just so good and so out of the blue. I think, you know, it's just a story that we'll all be following a lot.
Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning, Sinead.